welcome back to a very special edition of both the Inside Scoop and Take Action News. I am Mark Levine, sitting here with
David Schuster. So good to be with you, Mark.
And yeah, I got to tell you, it's fun to do tag team with you. It really has been my pleasure. I had the whole thing by myself yesterday.
You did a great job.
But now we could take it on together. Let's shut off the music since both David and I have a lot to say. David, you were gone yesterday. I'm curious. I'm in the maelstrom of all of this stuff, and of course, surrounded by all the people, and everyone's got a view. I'd be curious, down in Louisiana, was anybody talking about this, or is this just Washington stuff?
You know, it was actually front page headlines that the arguments were starting. There was also a lot of stuff about Rick Santorum winning the Louisiana primary on Saturday, where I was in the French Quarter in New Orleans. I'm not sure they know what planet they're on. But no, and in the political, for folks who are reading the papers or keeping up with the news, yeah, it's certainly a story.
It's not just Beltway people talking about this. It's a national story.
I mean, I think people out there understand that this health care law, the Affordable Care Act, I think most people realize that it passed Congress. Obviously, they understand the Obama administration pushed it forward. I think they sort of get that key parts of it haven't started yet. Other parts have started. And I think most people do understand that the Supreme Court is reviewing the Constitution. About the extent that most people sort of understand what's going on, and then you got to start going to law professors and people in the media or folks like us to sort of get into the nitty-gritty of what exactly is the Supreme Court doing, why are they having an unprecedented 3 days of arguments, what were the arguments about yesterday involving sort of this issue about could they rule on this before the taxes take effect.
Yeah, the Anti-Injunction Act.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think there's some confusion about all that, but it's, you know, people are watching, and I think people are waiting to sort of, in some sense, they realize that this will be a political earthquake if, in fact, the Supreme Court invalidates this law.
Let me ask you this. You were in New Orleans, or were you elsewhere in Louisiana as well?
I was in New Orleans.
Okay, yeah. Because as a son of the South, I'm from Nashville, Tennessee. Anyone in the South can tell you there's Louisiana, or Louisiana, as they call it, and New Orleans. There's New Orleans, and there's Louisiana. And really, there are two very different places. You might find the city of New Orleans in the state of Louisiana, but both people in the city and outside the city will tell you it's worlds away from the rest of the state. I suspect the people in New Orleans were fairly supportive of President Obama and the Affordable Care Act, but I'm not so sure about the rest of the state.
I think that's sound analysis. I mean, you know, obviously New Orleans, parts of New Orleans, very progressive, mostly African American city. A lot of folks who are on Medicare, Medicaid, who are relying on government assistance for health care and whatnot. And I think certainly in the city, it almost sort of tracks the politics. If you look at elections in Louisiana, New Orleans, of course, usually reliably Democratic, the rest of the state extremely conservative. So I think that's true.
Let me ask you a question. It's a little bit off topic, but heck, we're talking about health care all day. How is Louisiana doing? I mean, I haven't been to Louisiana or New Orleans since before Hurricane Katrina. And, of course, it's so devastated the city. It's been now, what, five, 6 years
2005.
Now? 7 years. It's already been 7 years since Katrina. How about it? Are there still whole areas of the city that are completely destroyed? Has New Orleans rebuilt itself?
Well, like a couple of things, and this is sort of gets I could go on for hours on this. In part because I was in Biloxi when Katrina struck, and I was in Biloxi for 2 weeks after Katrina, and then I was in New Orleans for another 2 weeks. And as I was pointing out to a friend when we were in New Orleans yesterday, I said, imagine this city and being able to sort of ride around with no stoplights, no stop signs, no traffic, no people, and the only people you see are National Guard trucks and members of the media. New Orleans was a vacated city when I was there last. So I was struck by, you still see the water line in parts of New Orleans as far as how high the water went. There are still signs all over the place about 7 years later, but not forgotten. There's still a lot of homes, some neighborhoods that are still, you know, you have the FEMA trailers that are out there, which is what the government sort of passed out.
I thought they were done. I thought they closed down the last one a few weeks ago.
They closed down the sort of the FEMA trailer parks, but there's still some people who have FEMA trailers on the property.
I see.
There's been a lot of rebuilding, and the city certainly is very vibrant and back to life.
What about the Ninth Ward? You probably get a chance to go there.
Didn't get a chance to sort of see the Ninth Ward, but I actually talked to somebody in New Orleans about it who said that the Ninth Ward is still, it'll never be the same. The population was just sort of devastated. There was so much there was so much destruction, there was so much sort of water damage, so many homes were essentially, even if their foundations were still up, had essentially bacteria growing in them because of the water that was standing water that was in them. So the Ninth Ward will be is going to be devastated for years. And the other part about it is, I mean, folks in New Orleans are exceptionally proud of their football team, the New Orleans Saints.
Like as they should be.
Everywhere was the T-shirt Free Sean Payton, who is the coach who the NFL has decided to suspend for a year because of this scandal.
I agree. The suspension. I like the Saints, too, but there's no excuse for what the coach was doing.
Well, but there are all these T-shirts that say Free Sean Payton. So, you know, all over they talk about football. There are also, next to the Free Sean Payton T-shirts, are the T-shirts commemorating the Saints' Super Bowl win, 2 years ago?
Right.
And the headlines and the newspapers that were saved. And people talk about it as if it was a gift from God.
Oh, yeah.
That given what had happened to New Orleans and given the destruction along the Gulf, that the fact that the Saints were able to win the Super Bowl, that was sort of a divine sign that the Crescent City is going to come back.
They call him Drew Breeses, I've heard. So
there's a lot of pride, but it hangs in the air over everything. You talk to people about New Orleans and how the city's doing, and you know they say, well, we're getting back. We're getting back. And certainly, you know, if you didn't know that Hurricane Katrina had happened, if you didn't know anything about the storm, didn't know anything about what it did to the city, you could go there and you would, you know, not sort of see any signs. You might see some destruction here and there and some empty lots, but you wouldn't think anything other. But it hangs in the psychological psyche of everybody in New Orleans. One of the cities, I mean, that I'm very eager to get back to is Biloxi, where, I mean, the stories of particularly the impoverished areas of Biloxi that were, you know, had hit with a 26-foot storm surge and people who were unable to get out because, particularly in some very low-income areas, when the storm hit, it was the end of the month. And a lot of folks who were relying on government checks could not afford to fill up their cars with gas because of the timing. And they were out of money. And there were stories that we did for NBC News 7 years ago, and that will haunt me for the rest of my life, of one guy that I talked to the day after the storm. He had a rent-to-own furniture store in Biloxi. And when I first went back into it, I was sort of inland for a couple miles during the storm and then went back in and found this store, and this guy was crying as he was describing. He was pointing at the helicopters that were flying above over in Biloxi Point, which is a very impoverished part of Biloxi. And he said, you need to go over there and talk to us, find out what's going on in Biloxi Point. And I'm like, tell me about it. What's going on there? And he said, Biloxi Point is where a lot of my customers are, the people who don't have a lot of money who need to sort of rent furniture. That's all they can afford. And he said, and he started crying as he described the number of people in the previous several days who had come to his store and said, can you loan me $10, $20. I want to try to get out of here, but I can't afford it because the government checks aren't coming until after, and I'm out of money. And he was weeping as he's describing these people who they could not afford to get out. And most of them lived in Biloxi Point. And Biloxi Point was where Hurricane Katrina was the absolute worst. 26-foot storm surge leveled every house in that neighborhood. And there were hundreds of people who were killed, many of whom simply wanted to leave. They could not afford to do so.
You know, in all this discussion over health care, it seems that there are people in politics who can't seem to appreciate that someone just can't afford to pay for a prescription drug that saves their lives.
Right.
Or a woman just can't afford to buy the pill that might not be used just for contraception but to cure an ovarian cyst, like Sandra Fluke's friend. I wonder whether we're a nation today where the chattering classes, of which you and I are a part, but really have trouble. I mean, you were down there. You were in Biloxi. You were talking to real people. I wonder sometimes how many people in Washington, and I'm not talking about the politicians so much. I'm talking about reporters, too, get out and realize that there are 1 in 7 Americans that are on food stamps, that are too poor to afford food. I know someone who works in food stamps, and they get maximum, if you are an absolute zero, it's $6 a day. And I almost want to try and do it, except I'd starve. I mean, I try to go to the grocery store for an entire day, not one meal. I could do $6 a meal. $6 an entire day, every day for a month. $6 a day. And 1 in 7 Americans are on food stamps. And I sometimes wonder, in a land where, you know, Mitt Romney says that $350,000 is not that much, and his wife drives a couple Cadillacs, and of course, he's running for president of the United States. Has he any conception of the real poverty? People could not afford gas to get out of the way of a hurricane. People cannot afford money for a life-saving drug. I just don't know how many politicians, media people know of this. It's one in seven. It's not like it's a few people.
Right. And again, I think this gets to the key argument that we're having about, you know, whether it's healthcare, whether it's, you know, what happens when a hurricane strikes. It's, are we a society that defines itself by how we take care of the wealthiest among us, or are we a society that defines itself by how we take care of the neediest? And yes, Republicans are right that there are some lazy people in our society.
But every society has a few lazy people.
But most of those people that I met in Biloxi, most of the people who were in those very impoverished areas, they didn't choose that. They were hardworking folks who were trying to lift themselves out. I mean, there's not great public education in Biloxi, Mississippi. Folks were still trying to go to public school. Folks were still trying to graduate from school and go to college. They were trying to make something of themselves. But if you're born into an incredibly difficult circumstance, an impoverished neighborhood, where there's sort of a cycle of no role models and there's really no safety net for you, it's hard.
Of course it's hard. Maybe it's just where your sympathies lie, but in this time when Republicans are saying, I mean, you hear them on the conservative news channels and talk radio, you're attacking the rich. I was on Fox News. I remember Laura Ingraham talk about this poor minority. She didn't use the word poor. I don't know if she would persecuted or something like that. Minority of people, the 1%. And she's like, they're only 1% of the country. And I had to remind her that this 1% not only gets better health care and better living standards, they get better justice. I mean, O.J. Simpson did not get off because he had the best case in the world. Mm-hmm. He got off because he could afford some of the best lawyers in the country. We had on the Rockies Caucus on WPFW, the radio station I do, we had a guy from Maryland, a nice guy, a trucker, a salt of the earth, reasonable guy, hardworking. He was accused of murdering some little girls. He wasn't in the area, but what happened was a neighbor saw a sketch and thought he looked like that sketch. They put him in a lineup, and they told these two 10-year-olds that the perpetrator was one of the six. There weren't, actually. He was put on death row. He's put on death row for 2 years. He was in jail for 8 years until DNA conclusively proved that he had absolutely nothing to do with it. They actually found the real horrible rapist and murderer. I mean, a terrible, terrible person who was actually already in jail. And this guy lost 10 years of his life, 2 years on death row, where he's waiting to be executed. Completely innocent person. And I asked him about his legal counsel during his trial, and he said, well, I couldn't afford a lawyer. I was a public defender, and, you know, we spent a few hours together, but he didn't seem to really understand the case. And you know, money matters. And it doesn't just matter on things like, oh, you can buy a nice car. It matters on such, to me, when I look at justice or I look at health care. These aren't things like I'm living better than somebody else. These are basics. Mm-hmm. Justice should be around for every American. Healthcare should be around for every American. All right, you know, BMW is fine. You got to be rich to have a BMW. But if you can't afford justice and you can't afford healthcare, then what are we as a society?
Right. And that's where I think that sort of then takes us nicely back to why we're here at the Supreme Court or next to the Supreme Court today. And that is, yes, there are constitutional questions and we're a society that's defined and based on our Constitution. But we've heard over and over again so many people say there is a moral imperative to requiring every American to be part of the system. We're all, you know, we choose to be United States citizens. If you choose to be a United States citizen, then you should be part of the system. So that all of us benefit. And I think this will be one of the defining decisions, not just in terms of the Supreme Court, not just in terms of the law, not just in terms of healthcare, but who we are as Americans. I think this decision could not be any bigger.
You know, I've always been a student of history, a student of law, and one of the most fascinating times in American history was right after the Hoover years, right during the Great Depression. Of course, there was 25% unemployment, far worse. I mean, today it's bad. I guarantee it was worse in the early 1930s, as we all know. And when Franklin Delano Roosevelt had some really new ideas at that time. I mean, today when we think of Social Security, people barely blink. But the New Deal, the idea of putting people to work, the Works Progress Administration, and building bridges and having health care and having pensions and protecting unions and all these progressive ideals were put forward. And you had, at that time, a very conservative Supreme Court. This was a Supreme Court appointed in the 20s. It was the Harding, the Coolidge, the Hoover Supreme Court. And they didn't like those new ideas. And even though there was nothing in the Constitution to prohibit these new ideas, they said, it's new. It's never been done before. We have never had a government pension before, much like the people who are now saying, we've never had the government force you to buy health care before. And even though they couldn't find a constitutional reason to oppose it, they said, it's new, it's got to be wrong. And so this was actually, and legal scholars call that is the Lochner era. Because there's a famous case of Lochner v. United States, where in the state of New York, because it was the state of New York had banned child labor and said 10-year-olds can't work in factories. And progressives saw that as a good thing, saying that, you know, children should play and learn and not be out there working in families. And the Lochner court said, nope, that's contract. And 10-year-old can sign a contract and can be held to that contract. And it went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they said they overturned the New York law as being unconstitutional, an unconstitutional breach of power. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was so upset by the Lochner decision and the subsequent progeny of decisions, the one that struck down all his early New Deal laws, or just struck down one after the other, that he came up with a plan, which actually would have been perfectly legal, although, let's face it, it was absolutely political, to add justices to the Supreme Court, famously called the Court Packing Plan. And it was starting to get through Congress, which was on his side, and then famously legal scholars call it the switch in time that saved nine. One justice of the Supreme Court, I believe it may have been Vinson, but I need to double check that. Anyway, one conservative justice switched sides and suddenly upheld all the New Deal legislation. FDR shelved his court packing plan, and thus we have the whole body of law that has existed from the 1930s to today that, for the first time I've ever heard, back when they were trying to invalidate this, a judge that invalidated this in Virginia cited the Lochner decision in 1920. So we're back to where we started from.
And by the way, for everybody who's just tuning in, this is David Schuster along with Mark Levine. We are here next to the Supreme Court on a historic day, perhaps one of the most historic days of Supreme Court arguments that our country has seen in a long time, where the Roberts Court is taking up the issue of whether or not it is constitutional to require Americans to be part of the health care system. That's essentially it in a nutshell. Obviously, it's a little more complex than that legally. And We Act Radio, 1480 AM in D.C., we are broadcasting live throughout the day. And we should remind our listeners, folks who are out there, that we're going to make some radio history.
We are.
Because I guarantee there will be no other radio station in Washington, with the exception of C-SPAN Radio,
right,
that is going to actually bring you the audio of the Supreme Court arguments the way we will.
As soon as we get it. The difference is that C-SPAN is required to be nonpartisan. C-SPAN is just has to say, next up is Chief Justice Roberts. We're going to actually, I'm going to give live commentary, I know David is too, when we hear the arguments, tell you what they mean. Because let's face it, legal mumbo-jumbo is sometimes something that only lawyers understand, just like medical mumbo-jumbo is something only doctors understand. And I happen to have the Constitution in front of me. I am a graduate of Yale Law School, and I look forward...
And Harvard.
At Harvard College. And I look forward to taking these justices apart. David, you asked me earlier about one of Robert's comments on the mandate yesterday, and I said I couldn't really read tea leaves from that because it's on the Anti-Injunction Act, which is a pretty obscure statute. Today, they're going to get to the heart of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to get right to the individual mandate. If there are any tea leaves to be read, they are to be read today, and I'll give you my analysis as soon as I hear it.
And for folks who have never actually listened to a Supreme Court argument, Mark, of course, has done that many times, been in the Supreme Court. Once upon a time in my earlier years, I was actually a producer at CNN that covered the Supreme Court. And it's just it's a fascinating, fascinating process as you hear the marshal say, oye, 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 now sitting the Honorable Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the United States Supreme Court, bring nigh your attention near the United States Supreme Court is in session. And it's like, yeah, it's all mumbo-jumbo, but it's pretty cool.
You know, I've never argued a case before the United States Supreme Court, but I have had my share of appellate arguments, including before the Ninth Circuit, and a number of federal circuits, state courts of appeal, before three judge panels. Never had nine. Mm-hmm. Never had nine. But let me tell you something. Just standing there in front of three judges, knowing that your client's life or livelihood's on the stand, and let me tell you something. There's no, I mean, they may be slightly polite, but they interrupt you. They interrupt each other. They ask really tough questions, and just question you're trying to answer. One, another person jumps in. If three judges, let me tell you, it's terrifying. I can't imagine nine very highly esteemed, well, one won't talk. Justice Thomas won't talk. But eight highly esteemed justices all interrupting each other, asking you questions. For those lawyers, it is exhilarating and terrifying at the same time.
And we will have those arguments. So we expect that the audio will be released in about half an hour or so. And we believe that the arguments are now done. They went from 10 to noon today. And what the Supreme Court does is it takes them about 45 minutes to an hour to go ahead and essentially load up the audio and put it to digitize it. And then they send it out. And we will, of course, we will broadcast the audio, the arguments, so that you may start seeing reports on the wires and on the internet now about what was said at the Supreme Court. But if you want to actually hear it yourself, it's intriguing. And even if you don't have a legal background and don't understand the law, hearing the way they argue these things is fascinating.
And I'll do my best to explain to you without it's going to be hard because they'll be interrupting each other and I don't want to interrupt them too much. But to the extent I can explain what they're talking about, I'll do the best I can. Mitch, do we now have the interviews I did yesterday? I'll tell you what. We've got yesterday, after we went off the air, there were some interviews I continued to do right here on Radio Row in the Methodist Church across from the United States Supreme Court. And we can't always get all these interviews to you live, but there's some really good stuff that I really want you to hear. Who do we have up next, Mitch?
This is Representative Karen Bass.
Oh, let me tell you, this is one of my favorite interviews.
Really
that's probably the highlight of my day. I don't mean to diss everybody else. I had never met Congresswoman Bass before, but this is a new representative from California representing, frankly, an area very close to where I used to live. This woman, I am so impressed with her knowledge, with her friendliness, with her passion, and her stories, frankly. She used to work in a trauma center. This is the most real member of Congress, maybe because she's new, maybe because she hasn't been all jaded by Congress yet. I really enjoyed this interview. Mitch, let's play my interview yesterday with Congresswoman. Go ahead.
Before you do that, I just wanted, there is now a dispatch in from the Los Angeles Times on the Supreme Court arguments this morning. This is what the LA Times writes. The Supreme Court's conservative justices Tuesday laid into the requirement in the Obama administration's health care law that Americans have health insurance as the court began a much-anticipated second day of arguments in the controversial legislation. Even before the administration's top lawyer could get 3 minutes into his defense of the mandate, some justices accused the government of pushing for excessive authority to require Americans to buy anything. Are there any limits? Asked Justice Anthony Kennedy, one of the three conservative justices whose votes are seen as crucial to the fate of the unprecedented insurance mandate. Chief Justice John Roberts suggested the government might require Americans to buy cell phones to be ready for emergencies.
This is not good news,
David. And Justice Antonin Scalia asked that the government might require Americans to buy broccoli or automobiles. If the government can do this, what else can it do? Scalia asked.
I got to tell you, you wanted tea leaves? These are some nasty tea. It's brewing and it's hurting. I have told you all along, I said this all day yesterday, that while I thought the Constitution and the law was clear, I had a lot more faith in the Constitution than I do in five people wearing robes. The thing from Anthony Kennedy scares me most of all, because sure, I knew we lost Thomas. I never expected much from Alito. Possibly Roberts or Scalia would be consistent with their past views, but that would require them to put the Constitution ahead of their personal views. I didn't think they were going to do that. But Justice Kennedy, the ultimate swing vote, he's the one they've got to convince, and it'll be interesting to hear the actual argument. He could just be asking it rhetorically, you know, give me some limits. My hope is that the lawyer did give him some limits and gave him something to stand on. There, by the way, are principled limits to the Commerce Clause. There, two recent cases, the Morrison case and the Lopez case, come out differently from the two cases I talked about, the wheat case and the marijuana case. In those cases, actually, both involved violence against women or guns at school. Basically, Congress trying to regulate criminal laws or gun possession, and they basically said, you know what, a gun near a school or violence against women, these aren't national issues, these are local issues. I don't even know if I agree with those decisions, but those decisions are certainly there. There are limits on the Commerce Clause, and whatever you think about guns near schools or violence against women, I think it's pretty easy to argue that interstate commerce is far more affected by the healthcare market than by either of those cases.
And Justice Kennedy, again, these are excerpts that are coming out because the arguments for today are now done. They've had their 2 hours, and the Supreme Court is preparing to release audio, which we will run here on WEAC Radio in about half an hour or so, but we're just starting and get some reports now from reporters who were inside the Great Hall. And it does appear as if there were some very critical questions that Anthony Kennedy, as Mark Levine has pointed out, is a swing justice in this case, seem extremely critical of the government mandate. He described it as changing the relationship of the individual to the federal government.
Uh-oh.
Again, we're going to play the audio in a half an hour and try to sort of put it in some larger context. And sometimes the justices ask questions because they're trying to get the lawyer to make a case that will convince them. But I'm with you. I think it, you know, for people who are looking for some indication that maybe Anthony Kennedy Roberts would be open to this, I'm not sure that that was there this morning.
This is as I feared. Again, we don't know the results yet. So far, these are just tea leaves, but we know a lot more than we did yesterday, and it doesn't look good. I just got to tell you, it doesn't look good.
With that, why don't we then go ahead and we'll run some of the interview that you did yesterday. And again, we're going to get some more of these reports in the next half hour to sort of set up for you what happened this morning. Again, the Supreme Court has now finished their 2 hours of arguments on the government mandate and whether it is constitutional, and the early reports of that to the conservative justices, including Kennedy, seen as a swing vote, were extremely critical of the government mandate.
All right. So on a happier note, I want to play for you my terrific interview yesterday with Congresswoman Karen Bass. She is a representative from the Los Angeles area of California. She used to work in a trauma center. And really, this was the highlight of my time here yesterday. I'm sitting here. I've been having this great conversation with Congresswoman Karen Bass. Now, she is a rare, rare person in Congress. She is one of what she calls the Noble Nine, one of the only nine Democrats, new Democrats, elected to Congress in 2010. We all know that was a very bad year for the Democrats. One of the main reasons I think it was a bad year is because Republicans demonized the very bill that's up before the United States Supreme Court today, the Affordable Care Act. But Karen Bass managed, despite that, to win election in an area of Los Angeles, not far, by the way, from where I used to live. We've been reminiscing a bit, having a great time. Congresswoman Bass, it is my true honor and privilege to have you right here on the Inside Scoop.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So let me start with your election, and then we'll get back to some of the Affordable Health Care Act. In 2010, it seemed that everyone was talking about, Obamacare. It's not a word I use, but it's pejorative,
either.
And
right.
They use it. And what they do is they personalize this complex bill that helps so many Americans, and they blame it on Obama, and they blame it on the Democrats. And what I find so fascinating is the polls show that when you break down the bill into all its component parts, people overwhelmingly support having children on their plan, so they're 26, closing the donut hole, saying that the limits on healthcare profits should be there, making sure women have the same rights as men, ending discrimination against pre-existing conditions. I go on and on. Each part of the bill has overwhelming support. But when you take the bill together as one, particularly if you call it Obamacare, Americans were opposed to it and led to, let's face it, some real harsh news for the Democrats, except for you, except for the Noble Nine, in 2010. My question for you is, having run in that year, what was it like running against that, particularly with regard to the Affordable Health Care Act, and how did you manage to win when so many Democrats did not?
Well, actually, I mean, part of it is Los Angeles is Democratic. I mean, I won with 86% of the vote.
Okay, you have a great district.
I do have a great district. But my district, for example, were then and are now absolute cheerleaders for the Affordable Care Act because, they, if anything, they wanted to see the public option put in.
I did, too.
But they were very, very happy with the Affordable Care Act and continue to be, and I know that there's events happening all over Los Angeles today in support of it. But I will tell you, watching it from California during that time, one thing is that I thought that the Republicans got out there early, demonizing the bill and put the Democrats on the defensive.
But they did that in the 1990s with Hillary, with Harry and Louise and all of that. Why do we Democrats let them do that?
Well, I mean, I agree. And let me tell you, watching from the sidelines, now at the time it was being passed, I was also heading up the state legislature in the middle of California's
worst. Yeah, you were the Speaker of the House.
I was, during California's worst economic crisis since the Great Depression, and working with Arnold Schwarzenegger as governor, so I had a double whammy on me. But watching it, though, especially as a healthcare professional who used to work in the nation's largest trauma center, County Hospital, Los Angeles, and knowing what happens when people don't have health insurance, it was very personal to me. I also remember when I got the letter in the mail when my daughter turned 23 and I learned that she could no longer be on my coverage. You know, parents had no idea that that provision was even in the law until you got that untimely letter and then called up your insurance company and said, well, that's okay, I'll pay extra. And they said, no, you
we
can't cover her at all. Mm. People didn't even know that part of it existed. Now, I know that covering pre-existing conditions, I have no doubt that as of right now, and this is where Democrats today need to go back and document the number of lives that have been saved right now in the last couple of years. I remember a story about a baby that was born prematurely, and the baby was born right before the law changed, and the family was told that that was a pre-existing condition, and the child wasn't going to be able to have health insurance. It was a premature baby.
I had a doctor here just an hour ago who was telling me there was an infant that's 4 months old and had a pre-existing condition. It's like, the infant's 4 months old. You're not going to insure an infant for... What have they done wrong in
exactly.
their life? I mean, absolutely nothing, obviously.
I wish we could document, and as, like I said, as a former health professional, I know people's lives have been saved.
I want to ask you about that, because you've
yes.
worked in this trauma center.
Yes.
Under the law right now, or even before the Affordable Care Act, if you had an emergency and you didn't have insurance, you know, you have a gunshot wound, you're going to die any moment, you had to be taken.
Let me just tell you the story, the real news.
So that wasn't always the case.
No. It was the case and is the case if you are getting ready to die. But just think about all of these people, and I was explaining to this a little while ago, this was a routine occurrence in my emergency room, okay? I used to work Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the nation's largest trauma center. A person gets into a car accident. They break their arm. They are they're taken to the closest hospital. They stay there 4 hours until it's discovered they don't have insurance. They make sure the person isn't dying, and then they transfer them to county hospital where they wait 12 more hours to receive care. So that's 16 hours without any pain medication.
Well, no, wait. Do they
yes.
set the arm? At least?
No, they do not set the
so
arm.
So if you break...
They do not set the arm.
So, in other words, if I'm in a car accident in
yes.
Los Angeles and I don't
yes.
have insurance,
yes.
I go in, I need my arm set, and they say, sorry, you don't have insurance, you're going to wait 16 hours
That's
in
right.
pain until we get one of these kind doctors that will treat you for free to take care of you.
They physically either tell you to go to county hospital...
Or they kick you out.
Well, yes.
Put you in an ambulance and send you away.
Well, they don't typically put you in an ambulance. They put you in an ambulance, again, if you cannot walk. But if you can walk, they tell you to go to county hospital. They will put your arm in a box. You know what I mean?
How
so
nice.
That it's not, like, flapping around.
How nice.
But they absolutely
They'll probably put you in a coffin,
they
too,
do
if
not
you need
set
one.
The arm. They do not put a cast on. Now, they may or may not, depending on the hospital, give you pain meds. This is what happens every single day.
Couple baby
so,
aspirin.
Hey, when health care reform happened, to me, I visualized all of those people with trauma that I used to see every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. And the reason was because I was at county hospital. So by the time I saw them, they had already been transferred from one hospital to another, and they might have been waiting 10, 12, 14 hours before I had a chance to see them to then set their arm.
Now, County Hospital was probably one of the few in all of Los Angeles County, for those people who don't know, is the largest, most populous county in the United States.
Yes,
like 9 million
11
people.
Million
11,
people
11,
in
9 million
Los
when
Angeles
I lived there
county.
10 years ago. There's no county, I mean, it's bigger than most states.
Right.
There's no county in the United States that has 11 million people. How many hospitals did you have, like county hospitals, that would treat the uninsured?
You know, in I think there's about five county hospitals that
five
I
five hospitals
of.
Treating 11 million people.
Well, it's treating the uninsured.
The uninsured, but uninsured is one in seven Americans.
Right. So,
LA County, that's probably, what, 2 million people almost?
Easily, if not a lot more than that.
If not
because
more, because there's a lot of poor people.
If you add in the working poor.
Sure, sure.
People who are working, but they do not have, right, or people who are undocumented.
Right.
Absolutely right. So, see,
so
my problem.
Five hospitals for 2 million people.
Right. Right, and five hospitals that have had severe cutbacks. That's why you're waiting 16 hours. If there was more hospitals, you wouldn't wait 12 hours in my emergency
no,
room.
No, and if you had insurance, you wouldn't wait any time at all.
Exactly, exactly.
So what we really see is a case of saying, you know what, you're poor, you're not as worthwhile.
Right.
Your pain is not as bad. Your arm is not as worthy of being set. What we have here is a true violation, as far as I'm concerned, of the equal protection of the laws, because the idea that, to me, health care is a right, and
exactly.
not a privilege.
Exactly.
I mean, you know what? Having a car is a privilege.
Right.
But food, shelter, health care, education, very few things, what I would say, are an actual right. But in the richest country on earth...
The richest country on earth in the history of the world.
That's right.
And, how can
and
you
we're
not ma-
and we're
provide
making
health
people
insurance?
For 16 hours. The other thing that I find so interesting is it's not just a broken arm, but you have someone, for example, that has a heart condition.
Right.
If they were to get preventative care, take some heart meds, maybe it would cost them $100 a month or something like that, they wouldn't be in pain, they'd take care of their heart, everything's fine. They can't afford a doctor. They can't afford a health care. They don't take the medication they need for a year or two or three. And suddenly they need an emergency quintuple coronary
right.
heart bypass surgery,
right.
which, of course, is extremely painful. They cut into your chest and it takes many months to heal, and
also,
it's very bad for you.
But expensive.
It also costs hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Right.
When for $1,000 or so a year...
Right.
We wouldn't have, and who pays for that? The taxpayer pays for that.
Well, and you know, and that's where I think, again, we fell short a few ways. Number one, we should have promoted health care reform as a jobs bill. You talk about some of the best jobs in the country.
That's
you have a job that cannot
that
be outsourced. You have a job that pays very well. You have a job with benefits. And, you know, if you think about it, if we're going to extend health care coverage to 30 million people, who's going to take care of those people?
That's right.
You need doctors, nurses, technicians, janitors. You need all kinds of people, all levels of education to take care of that population. And so it should have been promoted as a jobs bill. We should have also talked way more about pre-existing conditions, because just think about it. After you hit a certain age, your age is a pre-existing condition.
Of course it is.
You don't hit 50 without having
some medical problem.
Or
60 or 70
exactly.
or 80.
And especially if you are a person of color. I mean, what African-American is not hypertensive by the time they're 50 or have diabetes or all of those other things? And so, you know, that alone, we could have advertised an awful lot more. Instead, I think we spent a lot of time talking about the uninsured. And I think that part of the opposition were from people who have health insurance.
Well, let me ask you about them, Congresswoman, because about 83% of Americans do have insurance. Mm-hmm. They get it through their employer. That's 5 in 6 of us. And a lot of Americans with insurance were afraid that their plans would be hurt
right.
if they had to provide for the uninsured.
Right.
How do you address their concerns?
Well,